How many of you here actually have worked with Sir Donald? Quite a few. And how many others saw him? He would have been delighted. Well, we're here this evening to take a look at his career and his contribution to British theatre. And we're very fortunate to have with us someone who probably knew him and knew more about him than almost anybody else who's alive today. That's the novelist, dramatist, the Oscar and BAFTA winning screenwriter, and the author of A History of Theatre, who began his career after leaving RADA by joining Donald Wolfrid's company. He acted for him, he dressed him, he became his manager and friend, and following a request in his will, his biographer. It gives me enormous pleasure to introduce Sir Ronald Harwood. Wolfrid has been regarded by some people as an old ham, a relic of a long-gone theatre who stomped up and down the country with a company of second-rate players in tatty old-fashioned productions and an eccentric egomaniac who most of the profession thought, to use the words of Margaret Thatcher, not one of us. I think he probably might have approved of Margaret Thatcher. Yet some of those same people did acknowledge that on occasion he could deliver a quite stunning performance. It seems pretty indisputable that Wolfrid himself considered he did the country some service. But how? Well, he took Shakespeare to the people at a time when, apart from the annual festival at Stratford-on-Avon and the Old Vic and the Regent's Park Theatre, there were very few opportunities for most people to see Shakespeare in Britain. His wasn't the first Shakespeare I saw. I was lucky enough to see Peter Brook's very first professional production with Schofield in it. But Wolfrid was my first Macbeth and my first Hamlet. And I wish I had the kind of memory that can recall every moment from everything I saw. Some of you may be lucky enough to do that. I can't. And I hope some of you are going to do that tonight. But my memories from those 60 years ago are very hazy. I do remember his curtain calls, more of which later, no doubt. And most of what I know and anything I say tonight probably comes from Sir Ronald's biography. Now, Sir Ronald, a few years after that biography was published, you wrote your play The Dresser. Now, many people have thought that was a portrait of Wolfrid.
Well, it is in part, I can't deny it. It's certainly inspired by him. I tried to recreate the makeup that he used for Lear as accurately as I could, and his eccentric behaviour. Eccentric is a euphemism. But the thing about Wolfrid was that he loved acting, and the actor in my play is having a nervous breakdown, which Donald never had. And he is at the end of his life killing himself by acting. Donald invigorated himself by acting. I always remember, this is in 1953, when I was first with him, we were doing The Wandering Jew. Terrible play. But Donald had been in it with Matheson Lang, and he was very loyal to the old actor managers, and he wanted to revive it. And Ellen Pollock played the wife of the man, I think, of Donald's wife, called Matthias. He was called Matthias, and she played his wife. And Matthias is the lady is dying, his wife is dying on stage. This is how the play opens. And Matthias is off stage looking for Jesus to come and cure her. And she has quite a long death scene, and she went on and on. Oh, Matthias, and Donald, I was waiting in the wings with him, with my tray and grapes and a chamois leather that he used to mop himself.
Peeled grapes.
Peeled grapes, so he had to peel the grapes. And he got those during the war too, but nobody knows how. Anyway, he started to pace up and down this one night, and she was going on and on, dear Ellen, he'll never come. He said, well, there's no point in me waiting around, I'm going home. She's never going to die tonight. And a typical Donald, he couldn't wait to get on. So the portrait of him in the dresser, there's no denying I couldn't have written the play if I hadn't been his dresser, but it isn't Donald, nor am I the dresser. So it's inspired by, but people, you know, that we live in an age of journalism, they like it to be based on something. It's very tiresome and I hate it. But I'm very pleased about one thing. Ralph Richardson, who I saw 2 days before he died, said to me, lucky chap, that fellow Wolfitt, you know. I said, oh, really? He said, yes. He said, when we're all dead, your bloody play will still be playing and they'll remember him and not us. And I know wherever the play is done, and thankfully done all over the world, there's always a note on Donald in the programme. So it's rather nice, I think.
When you joined him in 53, his years of touring were really coming to an end, weren't they?
We did. Well, wonderful. Donald, his Shakespeare touring came to an end. But when, let's see, 1953, and then we did another season at the Lyric Hammersmith, where he did two plays by de Montalon, the French dramatist, Malatesta and The Master of Santiago. And then he announced his retirement from the stage of the Lyric Theatre, Hammersmith, as Malatesta. He went forward and, my lords, you know, he did his wonderful curtain call, which I did reproduce in the play. And he retired, and it was in the newspapers the next day, Sir Donald Wolfitt retires. Oh, Mr. Wolfitt, this is the point of the story. Mr. Wolfitt retires. The next honours list, he was knighted. I'm going back on the road. I was his manager then. When he found out I was Jewish, he made me his manager. I was 21 years old. And he made me write to all the mayors of all the cities we were going to, something in the following terms, not, I can't remember precisely, but something like, Sir Donald Wolfitt is revisiting Manchester, the weekending, and would be very grateful if the Lord Mayor would receive him. Well, the Lord Mayor didn't know what this was, so we went for tea. I used to accompany him. I'd stand at the back, and Donald would have tea, and he lorded it over them, and he toured twice more. We went out with The Broken Jug by von Kleist, designed by Lawrence Irving, beautifully designed. And one more, I can't remember what the second one was. We did a double bill. But anyway, he went out twice more, but not with the Shakespeare Company. Those days were over. He never took subsidies. He didn't approve of public money being used for these purposes. He would have done if it had been given to him nicely, but it was always withheld. So he then didn't approve of it.
What was Wolfitt's own background? He didn't come from a theatrical family.
Not at all. No. He came from... I'm not good at the English class system, being a foreigner, but I think they call it lower middle class. His father was the clerk, who paid the workers at a brewery in Nottinghamshire, in Newark, where Donald was born. And his mother was a schoolmistress. And there was a brother and I think two sisters, a very modest house, and it was a very frugal, thrifty upbringing. Donald was not extravagant, to say the least, certainly not in paying the actors, and he, not himself either, you know. I used to put him down in the books for £75 a week. This is the 1950s. But he only ever took 25. And the owing column always said 50. I don't know how much he was owed by the end of his career. Thousands of pounds. But he never took it. So he was not a greedy man at all. But he left rather a lot of money, to my surprise. I was an executive of the will. And when we came out of the bank, I think in Andover, where he had to sign papers, I was absolutely astonished. There was a hell of a lot of money. And I said, Donald, I think that's wonderful that a touring actor has left so much money. He said, yes, not bad for a provincial mama. And it wasn't bad. I mean, it was pretty good. So he saved, and he gave Rosalind, his wife, £5 a week housekeeping from the 1930s. I don't think he ever put it up.
And
at the annual sales at the Galerie Lafayette, he would take her and they'd buy clothes for the few years, and that was how he bought her clothes. She never went out on her own. She didn't know how to write out a cheque after he died. I had to teach her to write out a cheque. Extraordinary.
He didn't go to drama school, did he?
Certainly not. What he did was, he wrote to Fred Terry, who was a famous actor manager of the day. He was only about 16, I think, and when Fred Terry played Nottingham, he banged on the stage door, he got to see Terry. Terry was rather impressed with this young man, who was so keen and enthusiastic, and he said, come and see me when you're a little older. And in the meantime, he became a schoolmaster. After he finished school, he became a schoolmaster, I think, in Bournemouth. And into Bournemouth came another provincial actor manager called Charles Dorman, who I met by extraordinary chance in the late 1950s. He was still alive, and I belonged to a club called the Green Room Club, which doesn't exist, I don't think, anymore. And I used to see him in the corner writing, and with his glasses, he was writing. And I, fascinated, I did a terrible thing. He used to scrumple up the piece of paper and throw it away. So when he left the little library where this took place, I went and a terrible thing to do, but I took up a piece of paper, and it was covered in figures, 8,000 minus 4, 3,000. So I was fascinated. When Donald died, I thought it would be interesting to compare how much other actor managers had left in their wills, and I went to Somerset House and looked up the wills, and Doran also left a lot of money, and that's what he was obsessed with. So he came from a very ordinary background, then he joined Doran's company and played, what is that part in The Taming of the Shrew? Not Botticelli, one of the...
Biondello.
Biondello. And also in the company was Sir Ralph Richardson. They were both from the same company. And from that, Donald went on and on into bigger and better companies.
And this is really how he learnt the trade.
Absolutely.
And he had a great admiration for people like Terry and Ben Webster.
That was Donald's tragedy, that he was in love with the past. He was an anachronism in 1936 when he formed his own company. He was already an anachronism. That simply did not exist, the notion of the actor-manager. But that's what he owed his allegiance to, heart and soul, and he wanted more than anything to become an actor-manager.
Not entirely true, because there were people like Olivier who were being actor-managers.
But they were financed by Hugh Beaumont. They weren't with their own money.
Ah.
Donald used his own money, and he sometimes got money from other sources. One was the Countess of Plymouth, I remember. She gave him £200. And his daughter, her daughter, allowed her to be an ASM, unpaid, of course. And whenever she came round after performance, I had to show her into the room. Donald became so obsequious, it was sickening. Your ladyship, Countess. Oh, he was extraordinary. But mostly it was his own money.
Was he that obsequious to people who he respected in the theatre?
Was he? I didn't see him with many people obsequious in the theatre. I once saw him with Olivier, and he was quite intimidated. And he knew Gielgud, of course, because he played with Gielgud in Richard of Bordeaux at what was then the New Theatre. He played Mowbray. He played it at the Vic in Richard II. And they wanted somebody else, because John Gielgud didn't like Donald. But they couldn't find somebody else, and Donald played it. And that was one of his first West End appearances. But I don't know if he was... He was very cross when poor Sir John had a problem, public problem, was arrested and things. And Donald said, there'll never be another knighthood now. That's what worried him. That's what worried him. But there was.
He publicly tended to be very anti-gay.
Well, yes, I know he publicly pretended to be a lot of things, but he wasn't really. I mean, because of the war, he had to employ a lot of gay men in the company because the able-bodied men, as Sir says in The Dresser, are all at the war. And somebody said to him in my presence when I was changing him at the end of a performance, he was going on about gays in some ways, and the man said, but you know, so-and-so, who was in the company, so-and-so is queer. He said, yes, but he's harmless. And one day, Ned Sheeran told me this, a young actor, who's not gay at all, gave Donald a lift to rehearsals. And Don was sitting in the passenger seat, and this young man was frightfully nervous having to drive Sir Donald to thing, and his hand slipped off the gear and landed on Donald's knee. And Donald said, and he said, oh, I'm so sorry, Sir Donald. And Donald said, don't worry, my boy, we're used to that sort of thing in the theatre. He was wonderful, Donald. He was wonderful. I miss him terribly. When I ever go into the Garrick Club, which he proposed me for membership, I always want him to be sitting under the stairs and greeting one with that bonhomie that he had. He loved the Garrick Club. It was his social life, entire social life. He didn't have many close friends, but he did at the Garrick. He had Garrick Club friends, and that was very important to him.
This was somewhere he felt comfortable and belonged.
He felt it was a sign that the establishment accepted him. He was terribly worried about the establishment. And this is on a personal note. The reason that I endeared myself to him was I was at RADA. And at the end of my first year at RADA, my mother wrote and said she was a widow, she could no longer afford the fees. And by chance, I got to hear that Sir Donald was doing a season of Shakespeare plays at the King's Hammersmith, and I wrote to him, and I was turned down, but with just a printed card saying, Mr. Wolford's company's full. But I knew one of the two people I first knew in London. One was called Raymond Marriott, who was the drama critic of the Stage. And I was having supper with him on the night I got this card. I said, well, I've had my first rejection. He said, you fool, I know Wolfitt very well. I'll write to him on your behalf. Wolfitt saw me at the Waldorf Hotel on the foggiest day I can remember, the last great piece super in London, and he gave me a job. Where was I? What was I going to tell you? I know what it was. I then tried to stay on at RADA. I tried to get a scholarship, which I couldn't get. And then Sir Kenneth Barnes, who was the principal of RADA, heard I was in the Wolfitt Company. And he summoned me, and he said, you must make a choice. You can either go on at RADA or join Wolfitt. Well, there was no question of a choice. I joined Wolfitt. And Wolfitt thought that was an amazing gesture. I don't know if he realised it was out of necessity as well, but he thought that RADA represented the establishment. And he thought anyone who would choose him in preference to the establishment was a man to reckon with, and that was me.
But he must have thought that those old actor managers he worked with were a sort of establishment of their own.
They were in their day, Howard, but they weren't when Donald was... By the time Martin Harvey probably had retired, I can't remember who the last of them were that Donald would have overlapped with. Matheson Lang was dead by then, I think. There weren't any. There were people about that were touring, but not of Donald's stature.
No.
Donald was a great actor. And there were very few of those who were doing it themselves in the way Donald did. So it was already passed.
He also went off and played a season of Rep in Sheffield. In fact, more than one season, I think.
He did two seasons, I think, yes.
And he came to the attention there of the critic Harold Hobson, who perhaps wasn't yet the critic.
I don't remember that, did he? Oh, well, there you are.
And Hobson wrote to him later, I used to walk home excited, exalted, and aglow after some performances of yours in Shaw, Galsworthy, and Barry. I was as much moved by them as I have been by any actor in the theatre.
That's wonderful. I've never seen
and
that.
And that's the young, relatively inexperienced. Yes.
Well, you know, he was a very successful Hamlet, the Hamlet you saw. I never saw that. But John Masefield thought it was the greatest Hamlet he'd ever seen. The problem with Donald was when you told him he was very good in a part, he went on playing it for too long. And he went on playing Hamlet till he was in his 40s. But he put on a hell of a lot of weight, and it was past. I mean, the moment was past.
And he played Hamlet in the quarto version for William Powell.
Yes.
Who also seemed to have thought very highly of him.
Well, Donald always said he owed everything to Powell. And so did Edith Evans. They both were students. It's very difficult to find out what Powell actually taught them. I took Edith Evans to dinner when I was writing the book for research, but Dame Edith had a curious thing that very few other actors I've known have. She could only talk about herself. Strange, isn't it? So I never got anything about William Powell at all. But I was fortunate, when my first job with Wolfit, my first part was leading on Sir Lewis Castle as Tiresias. He played Tiresias, and I played the boy who has no lines, who have had lovely legs in those days. And I had to lead him on. And Lewis had trained with Pearl, or he knew Pearl well. And all I know is that they had a way of giving inflections that were tunes. And I can remember to this day the opening chorus of Oedipus the King, which was the play, in Thebes City of Light is the first line. And Lewis would say, when the chorus did, he'd say, no, pa-pa, pa-pa-pa-pa. And they would have to go in Thebes, City of Light. I can remember, it's clear in my ear now. And William Powell used that as a method for making the poetry both poetic and clear. And that's all I could get, ever. Because I never asked Donald, unfortunately, about William Powell in detail. And as I say, Dame Edith was reluctant to talk about anyone else.
He's got a lovely story, I think, in his book, rather than yours, carrying a very heavy case up a hill when Pearl took him up to be photographed as Cassius.
Tell it, I can't remember.
It took too long to find that. He went on to play Hamlet at Stratford.
That was his main real success. Yes, that was. Yeah. There were two things that happened in Stratford that were vital to Donald's life and career. One was the Hamlet, which elevated him to a leading actor. He got wonderful reviews. And the second thing was playing Kent to Randall Ayrton's Lear. Randall Ayrton came to the theatre very late. He was in his 50s, I think, when he decided to be an actor. He was a market gardener near Stratford. And apparently his Lear was a spectacularly wonderful performance. And Donald played Kent and was meant to be marvellous as Kent. One can see that. One can feel that Donald would be good. And Donald never failed to acknowledge Randall Ayrton as the inspiration of his own Lear, which was a majestic and mighty performance. I've seen most of the Lears of the last 50 years, and nothing comes near Donald. I don't care who your favourite Lear is, none of them come near him for barbaric Elizabethan power. It was a glory, one of the glories of the Western world, I think.
He went on to have huge successes with one or two other roles as well. Volpone.
I played
Master
in that.
Master Builder.
Yeah.
Clandestine Marriage. And Lear, of course.
Well, Clandestine Marriage, much later. The Clandestine Marriage at the Vic, with Tyrone Guthrie directing. I'm not sure about all those performances. Volpone was very fine. We did it at the King's Hammersmith. The Clandestine Marriage was, I thought, a little acted. He kind of performed it rather than being it. But the Master Builder, I didn't think, was good at all. And at the end, when Solness ascends they see him, you know, they talk about him going up the steeple to put the wreath over the steeple, the Master Builder. Donald had Wagner's pum pa 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 pum pum pa pa pa. Dreadful. I didn't think it was such a terrific performance. I played in it with him. I played Rania, the young clerk.
When he had started his own company, who directed the shows?
Who did? There was a man, it'll be in my book, a man called Lang. He was a well-known director. And we had a wonderful director at the King's Hammersmith who did School for Scandal, was Balliol Holloway. Now, curious enough, when I had dinner with Dame Edith that night, that was the one person she spoke glowingly about. She said he was the greatest actor she ever played with. They did Antony and Cleopatra together.
Kennedy played largely at Stratford.
He did.
To go elsewhere.
He never came into the West End. He was a dearest man and died in very sad, impoverished circumstances. And Donald was wonderful to him, gave him money and went to see him. And he had sores on his back bay and Donald used to rub in balm. It's the most touching scene. To this day, it's a haunting scene. He lived in Thayer Street or Manchester Square, somewhere there. And he directed, and Donald took direction. When we did The Strong and Lonely, many years later in the 50s, Margaret Webster, who was a distinguished American director and the daughter of Ben Webster and Dame Mae Whitty, she directed us in that. And she had terrible trouble with Donald. I mean, really bad trouble. Do you want me to talk about that?
Yes, please.
The play begins in the written version. It's by a man called Eric Hochhut, I think, if I can check. It's set in Paraguay in a Jesuit college, and the father provincial, Donald Wolfert, is seated cross-legged on the floor with two Indian converts either side of him. And I can't remember it in detail, but he says, "Do you accept the teachings of our Lord Jesus Christ?" And they say, "We do." And he goes through a slight bit of catechism, and he blesses them and says, "Come back on Sunday and you will be received into the church." And then somebody comes on and the play begins. And that's how we did it while Peggy Webster was there. We opened in Nottingham, I remember, and she had to go back to the United States. On the second or third night, or the third day, Donald called a rehearsal. And he changed it. The two Indian lads were seated downstage. There were other priests waiting. And then he got one of them to say, "Where is the Father Provincial? Look, here comes the Father Provincial. The Father Provincial is coming." Well, when Peggy Webster saw that on her return to London, she was outraged. And she tried to change it back, but Donald wouldn't have it. He loved his round. And he didn't like anybody else getting a round either. Ernest Milton, he was a great actor. Do you remember him?
Yeah.
Had a wonderful voice, spoke like that. Ernest and Donald had a famous scene in the second act, which Ken Tynan described as seeing two wonderful actors upstaging each other for the greater glory of God. The Jesuit motto. And Ernest, when he exited, used to get around. And it stopped. And Ernest came to me. I was the manager of the company and also in it, but and the understudy and playing a small part, all for £7 a week. Ernest came to me and said, "Ronald, do you know why my little patter has disappeared?" I said, "No, I'm afraid I don't." He said, "I shall stay back and watch tonight." Well, he played the scene and came off, and Donald was left on stage alone for about 2 minutes. Okay? And then Ernest watched this, and he came up to me and said, "I know why my little patter has stopped. That bugger is doing everything." And he was. He was walking and doing. And there was no round for Donald that night.
When he revived production with his own company, did he bring the director back for that? Or
not in my time. The Clandestine Marriage was directed by, I can't remember who did it originally at the Old Vic. Hugh Hunt, I think. No, he didn't. He did it himself.
An Irishman.
Who?
It was an Irish actor.
Oh, yes, you're right. It was Michael McLearmore's partner. You're absolutely... Hilton Edwards, correct. Thank you very much.
Hilton directed something for him, didn't he?
Yes, he directed The Clandestine Marriage. And he adored Hilton. And he didn't bring him back, no. It would have been too expensive. He couldn't have afforded that. Well, he could have, but he didn't. And he was funny about being told what to do. That was the row with Guthrie. I mean, one of his great performances was as Tamburlaine. It was an amazing performance when he crawled over the map of the world on the stage. Somebody wrote to me very recently and said, "I can remember Wolfert tearing up, I think he tears up the New Testament in the play, or
the Quran. They burn the
Quran. He burned the Quran. That's right. And he said, that was to me the only time I've ever felt that someone was being truly blasphemous. I mean, Donald was marvellous at that kind of savagery of acting. But his row with Guthrie, there are many versions of it. The actors wouldn't stay downstage of him. There were just terrible problems during the production, and Guthrie and treated everybody the same, which Donald didn't like. He wanted to be treated as the leading man. It had been his own company. He'd been used to having his own company and being the father figure and the respected centre of events, and Guthrie wasn't having that. And it hurt Donald's ego, and he manufactured a set of circumstances which obliged him to leave. And he left.
Which seems to me to have been a very big mistake.
Well, I do too. I think I do too. Though if he hadn't done it, I would never have met him. So it's not that great mistake. I don't know. It's just how Donald was. You cannot... If only are the two most ridiculous words in the English language, I think. If only what? You know, what would he have done? He did go into the West End. He took over from Eric Portman in His Excellency, a play at the Piccadilly Theatre. It just wasn't Donald to do those things. What he wanted was to have his own company, people around him that he loved or at least liked, and who admired him and who were frightened of him. He liked instilling fear. I remember when the BBC did an obituary programme to him called The Night Has Been Unruly, K-N-I-G-H-T. Harold Pinter was also in the 53 company with me. He and I were asked to be in it. And we were waiting in the little hospitality room to go on and do our recording. And the producer came in, John Drummond he was called, and said to us, "What's the thing you most remember about Wolfit?" And both of us, in one word, said, "Terror." He was frightening in the theatre. There was an actor in our company called Joseph Chilton, who'd been a prisoner of war under the Japanese, and had suffered terribly. He was the sweetest of men, but he'd had a terrible war. And he used to hide from Donald. He said, "I'd rather be in a Japanese prison." This is true. He was absolutely frightening. And if anybody made a mistake or a prop wasn't set when it should have been, oh, God, better to get out the way.
Eleanor Elder, who we worked with in his earlier years, when asked about him, I can't remember the exact quote, but I think she said something like, an egoist and ruthless.
Well, an egoist, certainly. But do all egoists have an inferiority complex? I don't want to play amateur psychologist here, because I think it's a dreadful game. But Donald was very, very insecure. And that is, in a sense, a reason for his outrageous behaviour. And certainly ruthless. I think Coral Brown summed it up best. Of all the descriptions I know, she said, "Acting with Donald Wolfit is like being a piece of fluff on a carpet being approached by a Hoover." And it's a magnificent description. Because there was this kind of force that came down on you. One night in Oedipus the King, Sir Lewis Casson had the idea to take a ping pong ball and cut it in half and put it over his eyes, Tiresias, the blind prophet, so he had these swollen, bulging eyes which he painted blue and pink. It was really frightening, with tiny pinpricks so that he could see, or said he could see. And on one night, I led him on, and then I had to stand aside in the dark, and Lewis did his stuff for prophesying Oedipus' future, and he lost his sense of direction, and he went straight for the orchestra pit. And the chorus, which included Harold Pinter and Alan Owen, a whole lot of them, went charging to get him and knocked over what was meant to be a great stone fountain in it. And Donald was already off by then, and he stood in the wind saying, get him off! Get him off! And I didn't know what I was, my first job, there was Lewis Casson. I didn't know what the hell to do. And Donald came on and lifted him, put him in my arms, and said, get it off! I mean, he was, ruthless is not the word. Wonderful story about St. Louis. You know, St. Louis was a member of that wonderful Christian socialist movement of the late 90s and the early 20th century, Ian Sibyl. And Donald was not left-wing. I should make this absolutely clear. Except he didn't like Mr. Heath, because you could see his bottom teeth when he smiled. Never trust a man if you could see his bottom teeth. Lewis came on one night with his wig all crumpled, and Donald said to his manager, his administrator, Llewellyn Rees, he said, Llewellyn, send Lewis Casson to me. Now, there was a problem for that, because Lewis was a knight, a theatre knight, and Donald was in awe of the hierarchy, and he suddenly changed his mind. He said, no, no, it's too soon after Stalin's death. I was present, so I can vouch for it. Wonderful moment.
Apart from the stamina he must have had, all those huge roles he played.
Well, 8 a week.
Yeah, I mean, he must have been actually physically very strong.
And he was massively strong.
There's a story, I can't remember what the play was, but there was a piece of scenery which had somebody behind holding it up who was drunk.
It was on coronation, just the week of the coronation, 1953, King Lear. What he had was a pillar. If you're the audience, here was the pillar. And Donald would stand in front of the pillar in the storm scene like that. How, how, all that. Inside the pillar was the prop man, holding it like that, so that when Donald leant back, he leant slightly forward. When Donald leant forward, he leant slightly back. There was no other way of weighting it in those days. Just two nights before the coronation, Fred, I'll never forget him, was so drunk, but we didn't know until he got inside the pillar. And Donald started to do himself, and when Donald leant back, Fred leant further back. It was a disaster that night, and Donald played the whole of that huge storm scene holding this thing with Fred inside. And when he came off, oh God, it was terrifying when he came off. Because he accused Fred of being in the pay of Binky Beaumont. Which I did think might be going a little far.
While we're talking about things going on, do tell the story of Sally Bussell.
Sally Bussell was the daughter of Jan Bussell, who did Muffin the Mule, who was puppeteer, which was one of the ASMs. And she there was supposed to be a big document, A New Way to Pay Old Debts by Philip Massinger. The denouement is Sir Giles Overreach, which Donald played, opens a chest and takes out a document which crumbles in his hands and can't prove his claim to property or what, I can't remember the plot, but it's meant to crumble. And Sally forgot to set it. And in the chest were just little bits of scraps of paper. Nothing big enough for this moment. So Donald threw open the chest, looked, saw there was nothing, picked up the smallest scrap he could find and went to all who were watching or listening. And he came off, and Sally was in a state of total despair and alarm. She's a lovely girl. And she came running up to him, and she dropped on her knees before him and said, I'm so sorry, Mr. Wolfitt, I'm so sorry. She said, he said, I absolve you. Somebody said to me the other day, don't make him like that anymore. As I talk about him, I sometimes wonder if my imagination is running riot, but it isn't, I assure you it isn't.